Thanks very much, Jeff, and thank you for being the reason that I understand, or at least used to understand, game theory. I'd also like to thank the Women in Economics Network and the Economic Society of Victoria and the people who've organised this event and put together this program. It truly is an honour to be included in that list of presenters of the Stan Kelly Memorial Lecture. As Jeff mentioned, this lecture was established 40 years ago by Bert Kelly in the name of his father, Stan. And both men were great servants to the people of Australia and advocates for free trade and an open economy. Now, obviously, I'm not old enough to be able to claim to have known either man, but as a teenager, I was certainly aware of Bert's columns in my parents' copies of the Bulletin magazine. Didn't read them, but I certainly noticed them. And, of course, the issues Bert championed in those columns, free trade and less regulation, were central to the policy conversation in the 1980s when I was an undergraduate here at the University of Melbourne. When Bert entered federal parliament in 1958, Australia was a very different place. The industrial structure was very different. Manufacturing accounted for around 25% of output and 26% of employment, compared with 6% and 7% today. Living standards were lower. Real household disposable income per household was a little more than half the level that it is now. And even that figure does not truly capture the difference in people's experience. In the late 1950s, the average household spent 20% of its post-tax income on food consumed in the home, compared with 9% now. And the basket of goods and services used to calculate real incomes did not then include overseas holidays, internet connections, or the array of electronic goods that it does today. Australia's economy was also organised very differently then. Almost all wages were set by a judicial process. High tariff and other barriers restricted manufactured imports. Agricultural production was protected and managed through marketing boards and other government agencies. The financial sector was highly regulated and restricted in the kinds of business that it could do. Because of this regulatory structure, by the time Bert retired from Parliament in 1977, Australia was a poorly performing, inward-looking economy. Economic growth and living standards were lagging other industrialised economies. Inflation remained higher as well. Productivity growth seemed lacklustre, and there was a general sense, lasting well into the 1980s, that the Australian economy was not world class. Indeed, the 1987-88 annual report of the Department of Industry, Technology and Commerce was titled Towards World Class. The supposition was clearly that we were not there yet. From their various positions, both of the Kellys opposed the system of protection all round. Stan joined with other members of the Commonwealth Tariff Board in opposing high tariffs. Bert became an advocate for free trade and dismantling regulation both in and outside of Parliament. Father and son both opposed the high tariff regime because it made the economy less efficient. It reduced Australia's living standards. But more than anything, they opposed the system's unfairness. Businesses and industries did well, not because they produced a better product or provided the best customer service, but because they were better at persuading politicians and bureaucrats that they deserve special protections. As Gary Banks pointed out in a previous Stan Kelly lecture, the system was designed to produce arbitrary preferments. Some firms and industries would be favoured, while others were ignored. So protection all round was far from a progressive system. It encouraged rent seeking. And the wage setting system didn't just support a basic living wage. For most of its existence, it enforced lower pay rates for women and excluded us from many occupations. The system also limited our thinking. By protecting Australian industry from imports, it created the mindset that local firms would never be able to compete. The idea that our industries could export abroad was barely considered. Over time, the Australian economy was liberalised. This took decades. Some of the reforms, including the tariff cuts in the 1970s, might have been partly motivated by other concerns. But they had the same effect as if they'd been cut as a deliberate liberalisation measure. They spurred domestic firms to respond. The floating of the exchange rate in 1983 was particularly important. For a commodity exporting country like Australia, subject to global economic fluctuations, a floating exchange rate is the best absorber of external economic shocks ever invented. And so it was that in the 1980s, the floating exchange rate absorbed the shock of our economy's increasing openness. Over the 2 years to January 1987, just before I started here as an undergraduate, the Australian dollar depreciated by around a third on a trade-weighted basis. Now, at the time, that depreciation was really sobering. I remember our lecturers telling us, that our economic students, that it meant our living standards had declined. I mean, it was also a response to that decline. And some important policy responses were needed to avoid a burst of inflation from import price pass-through. And these policies constrained real wages. But that depreciation made it easier for domestic firms to compete with imports and, perhaps surprisingly to some, to become exporters. Manufactured exports roughly quadrupled their share of real GDP over the subsequent decade and a half. And despite the boom in resource exports and the gloomy rhetoric that often surrounds Australian manufacturing, that share actually hasn't fallen that much since then. Some former colleagues looked at this transition effect a few years after it happened, and they found what they called a beachhead effect. There seems to be a hurdle to becoming an exporter, but once you start, you continue. Another way of looking at this transition is it was the inevitable result of a shift in relative prices implied by the depreciation of the exchange rate. But a third interpretation is that it was enabled by a psychological shift. In the era of protection all round, the presumption was that Australian industry couldn't compete with overseas suppliers. That was why it needed tariff protection. If you see yourself as inherently uncompetitive, why would you even try to export? But once Australia started opening its economy more to the rest of the world, exporting started to seem possible. And once you start believing you can compete, you have a chance of being right. The Australian economy of the 21st century is structured very differently than it was during Burt's career. But there are a number of parallels, and some of the challenges we face would seem familiar to him. Back then, Australia was said to ride on the sheep's back. Together, wool and wheat were close to half of Australia's goods exports in the 1960s. Agriculture accounted for more than 40% of business investment. Indeed, almost all of that agricultural investment was cultivated biological products in the national accounts, which is mainly livestock, but includes vineyards and orchards. But even then, agricultural employment was only 11% of the total. And the vast majority of Australians, then as now, lived in the biggest cities, far removed from agricultural activity. Similarly, in recent years, resource exports accounted for around half of Australian exports. That figure is likely to increase a little as new liquefied natural gas capacity comes online. During the recent resource export investment boom, mining investment exceeded non-mining investment for a period, much as agricultural investment came close to exceeding other investment back in the 60s. But even if you added in workers in sectors such as construction and professional services who were doing work on mining projects, mining-related employment is just a fraction of the workforce. That was true even at the peak of the mining investment boom. So again, the vast majority of Australians' economic lives are relatively unconnected to the biggest exporting sector. The past decade or so also isn't the first time Australia has seen a huge surge and reversal in the terms of trade either. The Korean War induced a boom-bust cycle in wool prices a few years before Burt entered Parliament. And just a few years after he left it, there was a surge in mineral commodity prices. This induced a boom in resource investment, though not as large or long-lived as the one we have just been through. Then, as recently, Australia needed to manage the consequences of this. Former Treasury Secretary John Stone tackled this issue when he gave this lecture in 1981. Then, as now, there were concerns that the economy would suffer from Dutch disease, where a higher exchange rate renders the manufacturing sector uncompetitive and industrial capacity atrophies. Often it wasn't appreciated that if much of the investment equipment is imported, the exchange rate doesn't appreciate as much as it would if it was mainly domestically produced. Yes, other sectors, including manufacturing, will find it harder to compete with imports when the exchange rate is high. But that isn't a permanent state of affairs. In any case, the international evidence is that Dutch disease doesn't necessarily reduce long-term growth prospects. For that to have been true, for it to actually reduce long-term growth prospects, the industries that get squeezed out would need to be somehow more important for productivity growth than those that survived. And that isn't what the evidence suggests. What seems to be more important is the quality of a nation's institutions and their ability to ensure that the benefits of the mineral endowment are not squandered through rent-seeking. Then, as now, there were concerns that our prosperity might be based on too narrow a foundation. Even around the turn of this century, I remember foreign investors during briefings on the economy telling me that Australia was an old economy. We should stop digging things out of the ground, they said, and start building microchip factories. Of course, this would have meant stopping the export of commodities in order to start the export of other commodities. And considering the relative price movements of iron ore versus microchips since then, we are better off for not having taken that path. I did literally tell a foreign investor that line back in the early 2000s, and it stuck with me. So there are many similarities between the resources boom of the early 1980s and now, but there are also important differences. This time around, the role of foreign investment in funding that boom has been less controversial. The labour market has probably adapted to the shock more quickly too. And we see this in interstate migration figures. Perhaps more importantly, the high wages on offer in the booming sector weren't automatically flowed through to the rest of the labour force in a centralised system. So the cost base of the economy didn't shift as much. And this time around, the Australian dollar has floated freely and has done much of the work to adjust to that shock. As some of my colleagues have pointed out previously, a floating exchange rate has several advantages in the face of a terms of trade and investment boom. As the exchange rate appreciated, the benefits of the income shock coming from the higher terms of trade were more evenly shared. Rather than the income boost going solely to the resource industry, lower import prices raised the real incomes of all Australians. If instead we'd had a fixed exchange rate, we would have had a balance of payments surplus. That would have represented a large monetary stimulus. And we know from the wool boom during the Korean War what the result would have been. Significant inflation and not much to show for it afterwards. As the mining investment boom turned down and became a drag on growth, the question was often asked, where is the growth going to come from now? Commentators started speaking of a growth handover. If mining investment wasn't going to provide our growth, something else needed to. And for a while, particular non-mining sectors did seem to pick up to become, in turn, the new engine of growth. First to do so was residential construction. It added much less to growth than the mining investment boom did, at least directly. Even at its peak, it was only adding around 0.5 percentage point to annual GDP growth. Compare that with the mining investment boom, which added roughly 1 to 2 percentage points to growth in each of 2011 and 2012, even after netting out the high import content in resource investment. Residential building work remains at a high level, faster than would be needed solely to house our growing population, but it is no longer adding materially to growth. You could argue that there are important spillover effects from housing. People need to buy furniture and other goods to complete their new homes, after all. But it turns out not to add that much. Spending on furniture and household equipment accounts for less than half the share of GDP that housing construction does, not all of it to furnish new homes. Housing construction contributed about 0.3 percentage points to annual growth over recent years on average, so any spillover via furnishings must be even smaller. This sector is not where we will find an engine of growth to pull us all along. The newest so-called engine of growth is public infrastructure. Like high-density residential construction, infrastructure projects serve as a good replacement for mining investment projects in a growth handover. The human skills needed for both types of work are very similar. And spillovers to the rest of the economy are probably even stronger than for housing. It is more apparent in the large stock of announced projects than approved projects than in current activity. But the program of public works in the pipeline is now much higher than usual. How much this will add to growth in any one year directly depends on how quickly these projects are completed. But there are also important indirect effects. Infrastructure work also supports activity in private firms because they are doing much of the work on these projects on behalf of the public sector. And we're hearing from our contacts in industry that is also spurring private businesses to invest in new equipment to support that activity. Better public infrastructure is also thought to boost productivity in the economy more broadly. Transport infrastructure seems to be especially good at this. Compared with the previous upswings in infrastructure spending a decade ago, transport projects are a much larger share this time around. I observe several things about this handover idea. First, all of the sectors identified as new engines of growth produce long-lived stocks of things: mines, buildings, bridges, railways. You can produce above-average amounts of these things for a while, but you can end up with an excess you don't really need if the boom continues too long. This is the problem with any kind of construction-related boom. The stock flow dynamics really matter. None of these sectors should be thought of as sustaining growth indefinitely. Second, in searching for a replacement for the mining investment boom, too often people forget that it gave way to a mining exports boom. That boom is now happening, and for LNG, it still has a bit longer to run. We anticipate that resource exports will add about a cumulative 1.2% to GDP over the next 2 years. Resource exports now account for around half of Australia's export revenue, and that will remain broadly true even if commodity prices fall a bit from here. Third, it is often forgotten that the rest of the economy had been squeezed to make room for the mining investment boom. Sectors such as tourism and manufacturing were affected by the exchange rate appreciation. Since the beginning of 2014, though, the Australian dollar has been, on average, 18% below the peaks it reached in 2013 on a trade-weighted basis. The squeeze naturally reversed itself when the investment boom ended. So part of the answer to the question, where is the growth going to come from now? It's all of the industries that have been growing more slowly than average during boom. A higher exchange rate can and did squeeze some firms so hard that they stop exporting altogether or even go out of business. This can have lasting effects even once the exchange rate depreciates again. Maybe the loss of export market presence or long-standing supply networks creates some path dependence. This would be the reverse of the beachhead effect identified by my former colleagues Menzies and Heenan. It'd have to be a pretty big effect, though, to offset the increase in overall productive capacity enabled by the previous investment boom. Now, there's nothing wrong with noting that some sectors pick up as others slow. But behind the idea that growth needed to hand over to something else, there also seems to be a presumption that the Australian economy needs a special something, an identifiable engine of growth, for reasonable growth to be possible at all. This view strikes me as being similar to the mindset that the Kellys opposed. The protection all-round mindset took as given that Australia had a cost base set so high we could never compete internationally without government help. The engine of growth mindset presumes that we need some sort of external trigger to grow, which for some reason cannot come from within. The engine of growth mindset also seems to divide industries into the worthy and the unworthy. Only good growth, we are told, is truly sustainable. And good growth, I can't help noticing, always seems to be defined as goods growth. Services don't count. There's a hint of the 18th century physiocrats in this mindset, but with manufacturing and business investment taking the place of agriculture in the firmament of virtuous activities. Much of the recent growth in employment has been in household services, such as health and education, which leads some to dismiss it as bad growth. Are people presuming that it's all driven by the public sector and therefore somehow artificial? Or is it that they think that jobs in service industries are all low-skill, low-wage jobs and therefore bad jobs? University academics, teachers and medical professionals would presumably disagree with that idea. Or is it just discomfort that growth is concentrated in industries where productivity is harder to measure? Or do people genuinely think that it's not really production if you can't drop it on your foot? The literature, in fact, shows that growth in health and education can indeed be good growth, sustainable growth. Both sectors contribute to stronger performance in other sectors. Better health outcomes are good for their own sake. They improve people's welfare. In addition, they improve productivity of individual workers and make it less likely that careers will be cut short and retirement income will fall short because of ill health. Similarly, better education is not only good for its own sake, it builds human capital, the better skills we all need to be more productive. To support growth and living standards in parts of the economy, it is important that the increased resourcing of and employment in the health and education sectors actually translate into better outcomes. This is an ongoing conversation in public policy and one I'm not qualified to add to. I will, however, note another connection to the Kelly legacy. The Commonwealth Tariff Board, on which Stan served for many years, morphed first into the Industries Assistance Commission, then the Industry Commission, and finally the Productivity Commission. Over the past two decades of its existence in its current form, the Productivity Commission has become the key public sector institution involved in developing policies to boost productivity. I note the Commission has recently published its five-year review, which contains many policy ideas for improving effectiveness and outcomes in the areas of health and education. The preceding just shows that, over time, some industries grow faster than others. For a while, the mining industry was growing faster than the rest. Other industries take the lead at other times, but it doesn't really get at the underlying drivers of growth. We need to ask, where will the growth really come from over the longer term? In answering this question, it is hard to go past the three Ps popularised by our colleagues at Treasury: population, participation, and productivity. And I'll go through each in turn. On population, as the Governor noted in a speech a few years ago, Australia's population is growing faster than almost any other OECD country. That has remained true over the past couple of years. The rate of natural increase is higher than in many other countries, but most of the difference is in the large contribution from immigration. Of course, just adding more people and growing the economy just to keep pace wouldn't boost our living standards. But there are two reasons why we should not assume that this is all that happens. Firstly, recent migrants have a different profile to the incumbent Australian population. They're generally younger, and the youngest age groups are significantly more likely to have non-school qualifications. This is possibly because so many recent migrants initially arrive on student visas and then stay. In line with that, service exports in the form of education have grown rapidly over the past few decades. Older migrants are on average less likely to have such a qualification than existing residents in the same age groups, but they're a small fraction of all migrants. The average education level of newly arrived Australians overall is actually higher than that of existing residents, precisely because they're younger. So Australia's migration program is structured in a way that, in principle at least, it can grow the economy while raising living standards. Secondly, increasing economic scale is not neutral. There is more to it than just getting bigger. This is the lesson of what is sometimes called new economic geography. Scale economies arise from product differentiation. Bigger, denser cities are more productive. Perhaps more importantly, larger population centres allow more variety in the goods and services produced. Fujita and Tisa quote Adam Smith, making the same point, and I will quote, "There are some sorts of industry, even of the lowest kinds, which can be carried on nowhere but in a great town. A porter, for example, can find employment and subsistence in no other place. A village is by much too narrow a sphere for him. Even an ordinary market town is scarce large enough to afford him constant occupation." So it is also with management consultants, medical specialists, and a myriad of other occupations that can only be sustained in a large market. The second of the three P's, participation, can and has been increasing average incomes and living standards. It's usually presumed that the ageing of the population will reduce participation. In Australia, at least, though, other forces have offset that tendency in recent years. In our statement on monetary policy released last week, we noted that the participation rate has been rising recently. The increase has been concentrated amongst women and older workers. That's also true of the pickup in recent months, as I'm showing in this graph. Older workers have increased their participation in the workforce as the trend to earlier retirement has abated. Mixed in with this is a cohort effect related to the increasing participation of women more generally. Each generation of women participates in the labour force at a greater rate than the previous generation of women did at the same age. There's a connection here with the increase in health and education employment I mentioned earlier. Better healthcare outcomes mean that fewer people retire earlier because of ill health, so participation rises. More extensive childcare options make it easier for both parents to be in paid work. And given the usual presumptions in our society about who has primary responsibility for caring for children, and that most people are straight, this shift affects participation of women more so than of men. So it's no surprise that the participation rates of women aged 35 to 44 have also been rising strongly in addition to the older age groups in this graph. And more flexible work arrangements tend to encourage participation by both female and older workers. In the end, though, lifting participation is a once-off adjustment. Once someone enters the workforce, they can't enter it a second time without leaving first. So greater participation rates raise the level of living standards, but it isn't an engine of ongoing growth. We must also remember that the objective is not that everyone must be in paid employment. Many people are outside the labour force for good reasons. For example, because they're in full-time education, caring for children or other relatives, or doing volunteer work by choice. That leaves us with productivity, arguably the most important of the three Ps, but unfortunately also the hardest to measure. It's also an area where distributions and firm-specific decisions really matter. Some recent international evidence shows that firms at the global productivity frontier can be several times more productive than the average firm in their industry. This research also finds that firms tend to adopt a new technology only after leading firms in their own country have adopted it. That is, the national productivity frontier first has to catch up to the global frontier by adapting the new technology to local conditions. So the average productivity of firms in an economy depends on three things. One, how quickly the leading firms in that country adapt the technology and match the productivity levels of the globally leading firms in their industry. Two, how large the leading firms are in the national economy. And three, how quickly the laggard firms can catch up once the national leading firms have adopted a particular technology. The findings of this research suggest that this last factor, the rate of technology adoption, has slowed down since the turn of the century. The policy implications of these findings are subtle and depend on whether you want to affect firms near the frontier or the firms that are lagging behind. For example, a more flexible labour market might make it easier for the leading firms to grow faster. Average productivity would then rise because those leading firms account for greater share of output. But then you would have an economy dominated by superstar firms. The implications of that are not necessarily benign. For a start, inequality could be greater. Median living standards might not rise. The drivers of innovation, like the drivers of creativity more generally, are hard to put pin down. But the literature does provide some pointers to them. First, and perhaps more importantly, is simply to grow. Growth is more conducive to innovation than recession is. Recessions do not engender creative destruction. They produce liquidations, which are destructive destruction. Indeed, when labour is plentiful, there is not much incentive to invest in productivity-boosting technology. And when everyone's sales are weak, there's not much incentive to try to invest to increase them. There is nothing quite like a tight labour market to make firms think about how to do things more efficiently. The pressures of strong sales or competition might spur innovation, but many other factors enable it. Infrastructure is a key enabler not only of productivity growth of existing firms, but whole new business opportunities. Often we think of communications infrastructure and the internet in this context. Transport infrastructure is at least as important, I would argue, which makes the current pipeline of public investment even more relevant to future growth outcomes. And that's partly because online commerce needs good physical logistics. Unless it's a purely digital product, something still needs to be delivered. Australia is a highly urbanised country, but it's also a highly suburbanised country. Improving urban transport infrastructure, as well as interurban transport, could help boost productivity across a range of both traditional and new industries. Also important is the political and regulatory environment. It would not surprise Stan and Bert Kelly that much of the literature finds that product market regulation and other devices protecting laggard firms tends to retard innovation. More generally, barriers to entry make it harder for new, potentially more innovative firms to break in. It isn't all about the startups, though. A lot depends on the propensity of existing firms to adopt new technologies and business practices. We think that this is one of the reasons for the slow rate of growth in retail prices in Australia at the moment. In the face of increased competition, incumbent retailers are having to both compress margins and use technology to become more efficient. Our liaison contacts tell us that they're investing heavily in better inventory management and other cost-saving measures, often by using data analysis more extensively. Adopting these innovations takes time because firms have to become familiar with the new technologies and change their business practices to take advantage of them. It wouldn't be the first time that computers, or perhaps this time the machine learning algorithms, were visible everywhere except in the productivity statistics for just this reason. Adopting new technologies and business models also requires a willingness to change. Just as views to protection can change, so can a society's attitudes to risk, innovation, and thus entrepreneurship. We saw, after all, that Australia's economic culture could shift from being inward-looking to outward-looking over the course of a couple of decades. Australia is normally seen as being a relatively fast adopter of technology, but there are some aspects where we seem to lag. One is R&D expenditure. While this isn't greatly below the average in industrialised countries, and many similar countries get by perfectly well doing much less, it has been declining in importance lately. Some other indicators also suggest that Australian firms have been, in recent years, less likely to adopt innovative technologies than their peers abroad. For example, while small firms are holding their own, large firms in Australia are less likely to use cloud computing services than large firms in many other countries. This wasn't always the case. A decade and a half ago, Australian firms were towards the front of the curve in adopting the e-commerce technologies that were new at the time. A lot depends on whether the workforce has the skills to use these new technologies, but at heart, technology adoption is a business decision. In conclusion, I think both Kellys would be pleased to see how the Australian economy evolved. The Australian economy of today is less inward-looking and more flexible in the face of the considerable shocks that can occur. Removing the tariff wall and the associated regulatory restrictions has enabled higher living standards and made the economy more resilient. As a nation, we're better off for that. There are challenges for any small open economy. Around the world, the policy conversation is turning to issues of inequality and inclusion. And rightly so. Liberalisation and reform are not ends in themselves. The focus must be on the end goal, the welfare of the population. If a specific reform doesn't deliver that, it ought to be modified, whether through explicit safety nets or other means. But in the end, the Kellys were right. Protection all round hurt more than it helped. And it left a legacy of disbelief in our own competitiveness. This is, I think, part of the reason why people search for engines of growth. That old era left an ingrained doubt that Australia can become more prosperous without identifiable external triggers. I believe that it can, and it will do so through continual innovation and productivity growth spurred by ongoing growth and competition. So next time, when somebody asks you, where's the growth going to come from? You can answer, from all of us, trying new things and gradually getting a bit better at what we do. We don't need to wait for something external to make it happen. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much, Lucy, for a fantastic speech. I guess a huge number of really important, interesting insights about Australia's, not insights about Australia's growth experience, and very adept at weaving in the Kelly story as well, so thank you for that. Lucy's generously agreed to take questions, and she's also very skillfully stuck to the time limit, not something public lecturers always do in my experience. So she's left 15 minutes for questions, so lots of time for questions. Maybe if you could just, when you ask your question, if you could just give your name and an organisation if you're from one. So we'd like to ask a question. Yep, in the middle.
Thank you, Lucy. Amy Lee from National Australia Bank. You talk about productivity and how, I guess my question is around how do we measure economic growth, GDP, and whether that is a good measure of economic well-being and how happy people are. So we talk about productivity, it's hard to measure, and increasingly the growth comes from the services sector, and productivity is very hard to measure. It's not goods produced. So I'm thinking we are enjoying more consumption, more services, faster computers, faster phones, and so which is all, you know, maybe all growth, but very hard to be reflected in the official statistics. Do you think maybe working more and consuming more doesn't necessarily make people better off? So bigger cities, people getting stuck in traffic, and faster smartphones, but not necessarily generating output, maybe an alternative measure of economic growth or output rather than GDP should take into account things like environment or social equality.
So I think that could be the subject of another talk.
You're right, quite right. So for the recording, the question was about the fact that it's hard to measure productivity in GDP, particularly when services are becoming more important. And, you know, the question of whether we're really getting at welfare using GDP as a measure when there are sort of more goods and services, and whether more more work and more consumption is necessarily welfare improving. So there's a couple of things going on there. So the first point is, I think it is harder to measure services productivity, but the Bureau and other statistical agencies around the world certainly do make state-of-the-art adjustments to try and get at that. So firstly, you mentioned faster computers, faster phones. They do actually make adjustments for that. So, a company brings out a phone at the same price but it's better, the Bureau does actually adjust for that, and so it's recorded as if it's a fall in prices. So that already does happen. It's not easy, but statistical agencies around the world already do that. The question of, the greater variety of goods and services available, I mean, that's exactly the point I made. Overseas travel and Netflix were not part of the CPI basket in the 50s. How do you adjust for that? Well, I think in some ways, it's the revealed preference of what people are consuming, and that's sort of also the answer to the third part of your question about, well, wouldn't it be better if we all did something other than buy more stuff? I mean, the interesting thing is actually retail trade is not growing that quickly, and we're consuming more services. So, we are voting with our wallets that we would much rather sit in a cafe and hang out with our friends while looking on it, or, look at our phone while at a cafe, rather than go shopping. And so I think, I think that's evidence that it's welfare improving. But, I agree there are things about health and education and other services that are hard to get at. So my favourite example in the health space, you've got keyhole surgery and you've got moon boots, those boots that people wear now instead of having a plaster cast and crutches. Both of those are clear improvements in terms of health outcomes and how quickly you heal in terms of... And you can measure that. So, the Department of Health certainly looks at, has a huge number of metrics about, death rates from surgeries and, cancer survival rates and all of those complication rates. These are all things you can measure. They're not easy to get into GDP, but at some level you can get some of that in there. And look, this is an ongoing question in sort of, the field of official statistics, and the Bureau does a lot of work on all of that. So, I think revealed preference says, we are choosing that, and it's not clear to me that we're actually choosing. Average hours worked by full-time workers is actually coming down. The share of part-time work is going up. It's not obvious to me that actually we are, it's unevenly distributed, I can assure you of that, but it's not clear to me that we are actually choosing a configuration of working lots more hours and just spending it on things we don't really enjoy. All right, there was a question down here somewhere.
Tony Ward from Melbourne Uni. Thank you for that, Lucy. One thing that worries me, or the most worrying thing, I think, is this final graph you've got. R&D expenditure. Do you have some feel for the sectoral breakdown of that? Is the
not off the top of my head, but I think it's one of those things that's worth looking into. you know, the you can measure, again, it's like it's a productivity thing. You can measure gross R&D spend, but, you know, the productivity of that in terms of what it then means for future outcomes, future inventions, future productivity, you know, may not be one for one. And, of course, you know, you don't have to do all your own R&D. You can adopt other people's work. So, and that's the whole thing. Australia, you know, going back to that turn of the century period when, you know, foreign investors were telling me that we were an old economy, Australia, you know, Australia wasn't inventing all the technologies, but we were adopting them really fast. And that turns out to be, you know, almost as good a strategy, if not a better strategy. Being the fast follower is actually not a bad idea. You've got to be a fast follower, not a slow follower. Okay, any other questions? Over here on the...
Ari from RMIT. This issue of growth makes me think back to the Club of Rome and the fact that resources either running out or getting very much harder to get down to, and also the issue of climate change and how that's going to affect our future long-term growth rates.
Both very important questions. I think, at least from the Australian perspective, we've still got a heap more coal and iron ore. There's still plenty in the ground that isn't being developed at the moment. And so in the statement on monetary policy, we had a box on the Chinese steel market. We think China has actually reached sort of peak steel in the sense that its population isn't growing much anymore and it's kind of got to sort of the peak steel intensity that most other countries that are not exporters, major exporters of steel, have gotten to. And China is just not likely to have exports as being a big fraction of its steel output because its domestic demand for steel is so enormous, there just isn't actually enough world for China to export to in the same sort of percentages that, say, Korea would or Japan, which are both the two main steel exporters relative to their domestic production. So yeah, I mean, as economies become more service-oriented, they become less commodity-intensive. And so we have gone through this period where some very large economies, China and India, are going through very steel-intensive phases of development and then it peaks. And so in some sense that's a bit of a one-off because while there's still a way for India to go, there isn't anyone as big as China or India coming up behind. So in that respect, the kind of demand for commodities is you know, I don't think the world will run out of iron ore. Remembering also that the vast majority of steel nowadays in industrialised countries is made out of scrap. So you don't actually need more iron ore to make more steel. You just scrap what you've already got. I think one of the interesting things is China has a relatively low percentage of steel made from scrap, and they want to increase that. So again, that's likely to, the demand for commodities is going to, moderate before the before we run out of them. Now, you then mentioned climate change, and that is a nice segue, given that coal is one of the important things that we export, and obviously, we do need to think about what that might mean. You know, you think about the Paris Agreement, the baseline versus some scenarios of what might happen to consumption of carbon using carbon releasing fuels like coal versus switching to renewables or becoming more efficient in our energy use. In terms of the raw, what would this mean if everybody's just stopped importing our coal? If it happened slowly, it would actually not amount to much in terms of the coal exports are sort of not even a percent of GDP in levels. And so if that dissipated, if you think of like BP's got some scenarios where they, their baseline looks a lot like our current forecast for coal exports. So it was their scenarios of sort of stronger reductions in use of coal around the world. Yeah, it would halve your coal exports perhaps or, cut them by a third. But if the scenarios they have, that happens over several decades, you would not notice that in GDP. You would notice, coal exports are lower, but, that wouldn't materially weigh on our growth going forward. And again, I think one of the things that becomes very relevant, as economies are trying to reduce their carbon usage is innovation. I think it's quite relevant just how much innovation is happening in the energy use space, both in terms of energy efficiency. You know, I hope you're all using LED light bulbs now, but also, you know, just in terms of, you know, the efficiency of energy production, moving to electric cars, moving to renewables as a source of electricity. That's all happening, and I think it would not surprise me, particularly depending on where China goes with this after the Congress. You know, they've made it quite clear that they're concerned about the kind of the environmental degradation that their industrialisation has imposed upon their economy and on their environment. And so, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if the authorities there do quite a bit to switch their energy mix, and that makes a big difference to, yeah, that makes a big difference to sort of the amount of carbon going into the atmosphere. So there was one other, it was over here.
My question was really about public infrastructure and productivity. And it seemed to me we have enormous opportunities if we switch from politicians picking something that was in an electorate and a big ribbon cutter, instead said, what's sensible benefit cost assessment? I would look at Kelly's, would jump up and down about the nonsense that goes on around it.
Look, you know, as a macroeconomist, I'm not going to comment on sort of the microeconomic, you know, cost-benefit analysis and how you best pick infrastructure projects. You know, that's certainly, you know, a view that a lot of people have put. And there are mechanisms, you know, Infrastructure Australia, and there are mechanisms for working out what are the good things. I think one of the hard things is if you take, you know, cost-benefit analysis really seriously, you often miss, you know, it's very hard to model the how business opportunities change. So, you know, it's not just, oh, well, you know, you put an airport here and you know, people don't need to drive to the airport over there. It's like, well, if you put an airport over here, suddenly a whole new industry of exporters starts air freighting food to China. That's a real example. So, you know, you have a whole new industry, and it's very hard to sort of get at that. You can't really predict how businesses, you know, are going to take opportunities to create whole new business opportunities as a consequence of that infrastructure. So it's a hard problem because of that unknowable. I mean, businesses take decisions under uncertainty all the time, but yeah, if you get too kind of mechanical about it, you may miss things that actually turn out to be really good, but are just the benefits are very diffuse, or, you know, the benefits are reaped by whole new industries that aren't there yet. So I think that's important. But I agree that, you know, it is important to think carefully about what infrastructure you're putting in and what the cost benefit analysis of that is. And that also means being open-eyed about sort of, you know, where the productivity benefits will come from, and, you know, recognising that, you know, we are in many respects an urban economy, and thinking about that.
I think we had maybe one last question right at the back.
Thomas Davis from Geographia. You mentioned earlier that increasing tendency for part-time work instead of full-time work. The IMF made a similar observation recently, and they said that that is contributing to depressing inflation rates
Okay, so the question, in case it didn't come out on the recording, was whether the increasing share of part-time work in employment is holding down wage growth and thus consumer price inflation. I don't think that we think that the increasing share of part-time work per se is weighing on wage growth directly. That's been a long-term trend over many decades. And additionally, I mean, there's just a normal pattern. When the labour market is slow, full-time employment falls, part-time employment holds up. And it's not because people are being sort of sacked. It's because just the flow from part-time, of people who currently have a part-time job getting a full-time job slows down at the same time as people continue to retire. And so there seems to be a normal mechanism there. And that's what we saw last year. And then as the employment growth picked up, and, you know, this year almost all of the growth in employment has been full-time, and it's been extremely strong. So in a cyclical sense over this year, that probably isn't the case. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the wage price index came out today, and, you know, it was still pretty low. Wage growth has been low for a while, and I think, as we said in the statement on monetary policy, it's one of the central questions about, you know, why, you know, when is inflation going to pick up, is when is wages growth going to pick up, and how much that's going to flow through. I think it's not so much the part-time growth itself, but It's more that as labour demand picks up, there are plenty of people who are willing to work more hours, and so the hours margin is where part of that extra labour demand is met, rather than through employing more people, and that seems to have a different dynamic in terms of wage growth. So it's not necessarily holding down wage growth as such, but it just means that as labour demand picks up, the effect on wages is less. That's our current thinking on that.